This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at SeavillePodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at SeavillePodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up in our right-hand margin. I'm Dan Daniels. Richard L. Beatles, who is the director of the Virginia Rail Policy Institute, gave a compelling lecture at the October 8, 2008 meeting of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia. His presentation was entitled, Preparing to Celebrate 200 Years of Rail in Virginia. SSV President Fred Terry, a distinguished railroader in his own right, moderated the program.
Good afternoon. I'd like to extend a warm welcome to our visitors and our members, of course. And some of these visitors look like old members, really, but he says we'd like for you to consider joining again. This subject today is, it almost ranks up there, I think, with sex and eating, because all we think about is the next two things we think about, how are we going to get from here to there? And, oh, get the hell out of here or something. That effect, it's always traveling. This industry is a real old, old industry, the railroad industry. It's not the oldest business now in the world, but it's an old, old industry, and it goes back almost 200 years. It'll be 200 years old in 22 years from now. And it was not a very progressive industry as far as new ideas or new improvements. And if you think about it, the track work was done with a pick and shovel for something like 150 years almost before it went to mechanization. So it wasn't a very high-tech industry, but it was a very important industry to our world, I mean to our country, to our young country. It tied our country together, and it was needed. We needed something as our country expanded westward. It was the backbone of tying our country together. And our President Abraham Lincoln, he understood that and when he helped to push the Continental Railroad. But getting back to this thing of change, it seemed like change was something that a lot of companies in those decades, they were against the change. They weren't too acceptable to change. And you and I, if we analyze our lives, we don't particularly like change all that much. We like to keep going along the same way. Kind of reminds me of a story I heard. These four guys were golf partners, and they were in the locker room changing their clothes to get ready to play golf, and looked over and old Joe had taken his pants off and had a pair of pantyhose on. And they said, Joe, when did you start wearing them? Ever since my wife found them under the front seat of the car. But anyway, this industry is a growing industry. There's two industries in this country that probably our younger people do not know exist at all, and that's careers in railroading and careers in railroad and coal mining. And I've been associated with both of them, and very proud of it. They're two of the strongest industries, and they're still going. And we need to let our young people know about the careers in these two industries. The railroads, I want to let you know, are the strongest. They have the strongest physical plant in the history of the railroad industry. They have the strongest and biggest and everything. I mean, locomotives, Royal and Rail, and concrete cross ties. It's nothing like it was back in the pick and shovel days. And that was only 50-some years ago, about 60 years ago, we started mechanizing. Our speaker today is going to give us some ideas in how the railroad industry can be a vital part of the future of our country's transportation systems of moving freight and people. And today it's a great pleasure to give to you, introduce to you, Dick Beatles.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Fred. I'm not looking for a new career. In fact, it's comforting to be with a group that builds itself as 55 and older, because two things. As you alluded, not many people know much today about the history of the railroads, how we got to where we are, and some of you probably do. So that's helpful to anybody trying to speak on the subject. I understood that my mission was to look ahead to the 200th anniversary, really, of rail operations in Virginia, which dates back to 1830, with the Petersburg Railroad. And obviously, we got that anniversary coming up, as Fred acknowledged. You know, it's it wasn't many years ago when there was a real question as to whether railroads were part of the transportation infrastructure that needed to be preserved and developed for future generations. I well remember, as do many of you, Fred in particular, the 1960s and the 1970s, which was a pretty dark time. Some of you may remember in 1968, the old Pennsylvania Railroad, which billed itself as a standard railroad of the world, and the New York Central, came together in a merger. Turned out to be an ill-fated affair. But in 1968, these two railroads merged to form Penn Central, and you know what happened there. In less than two more years, Penn Central was bankrupt. By the way, Rush Loving, who wrote a book called The Men Who Love Trains that some of you may have seen or read, said in his book that on the day that the Penn Central came into existence through that merger, they had between them only $13 million in the bank of cash. I had the good fortune to be for many years with a fairly prosperous little railroad in Virginia called the RF&P, and I went back and looked, and lo and behold, a little old RF&P had $5 million in the bank the day that the Penn Central came into being. So we were better off in Virginia then than the folks up in the Northeast were. But that was a grim time. The industrial economy of the Northeast was crumbling. The interstate highway network was coming to be nearly complete. Aviation, which had been promoted highly by the government, not inappropriately, but had been, that and the interstate were siphoning off most of the business. And it didn't look good. Well, I'm pleased to say, and I will give you further confirmation, I hope, of this in a moment, that there isn't any question now but what the railroads are going to be with us on that 200th anniversary come 2030. I don't know that many of us, referring to myself, will be here in 2030, but the great institution will be alive and, I believe, well. The only downside about speaking to a group that is primarily composed of 55 and over is, you know, it isn't a good idea to have slides or PowerPoint after lunch with a crowd like this, because I've noticed that a lot of heads bob around. So you'll just have to put up with my ad-libbing from scratchy notes. But I don't want to dwell too much on the past, but I think it's important to understand where we are today, to understand or to revisit, because many of you will have vivid memories of our transportation and national economic history dating from the 1930s, which was when I came upon the scene, not as a participant, but I did. You know, the Depression, economically speaking, although it had a little uptick somewhere in the 36-37 time frame, 1936-37, it really dragged on until the mobilization effort got going pre-World War II. And I'm kind of going to use the U.S. Army as a proxy for the state of the nation's industrial infrastructure, and most particularly the railroads. Some of you may have read Rick Atkinson's book, Army at Dawn, which tells his version of how the U.S. Army rose from its slumber post-World War I. In 1939, I'm told by reading Rick Atkinson's book that we only, as a nation, produced 6 medium tanks, that the average major was 48 years old, that come September 1, 39, when Hitler marched into Poland with 125 or 30 divisions, our military people claimed that they could only mobilize 5 divisions. Well, that's kind of the state of the railroads of this country as the 1930s wound up. But miraculously, they came to the rescue, transportation-wise, of the country, as did the Army and everybody who participated in that most memorable event. And other than my wife and family, World War II was the biggest thing that happened in my life until the last week when I started watching my retirement dissipate. Hopefully there'll be a turnaround. But right now, rail is hot. Hot as a topic of interest among those who are seeking transportation, mobility, congestion, ecological solutions, energy solutions. And one of the measures of that, I think, is the Wall Street valuation of the Eastern Railroads, which I've been following since the Norfolk Southern and CSX acquired Conrail and folded that operation into those two respective railroads. And so just 3 years ago, as a benchmark, September 30, 05 versus September 30, 08, the valuation of, that is the capitalization value, of the Eastern Railroads has doubled. It's gone down since September 30. But if Wall Street's opinion of value represents expectations, people are expecting a lot from railroads in the years ahead. I hope they're right. It's important, though, when you look at the potential and the possibilities, to differentiate between the rail system infrastructure and the rail operating companies, whether they be the Class I freight railroads or Amtrak, for that matter. We have we've seen an awful shrinkage of physical assets out there. To me, the most shocking measure is that in the 38 years now since 1970, the rail system mileage in this country has been reduced by 107,000 miles. Now, to put that in perspective, the interstate highway system, the last time I looked, was about 45,000 to 47,000 miles. So what we're talking about, and you all have driven interstates back and forth across the continent, imagine 2.5 times the interstate system in rail infrastructure gone. Now, that means for sure that you can't do as many things as even the economically crippled railroads of the 1930s were able to do in response to the mobilization and defense effort then. For years, there were a multitude of routing options. That is, everywhere two railroads connected, you could transfer cars one to the other. In many cases, you could transfer passengers one to the other. Since 1980, that has been dramatically reduced, as has the redundancy factor. So for a number of years, there were some wags among my associates on the railroads that used to say, we have only got two things to sell, service or scrap. And we scrapped a lot of railroads and we sold a lot of scrap. So here we now find ourselves in need of more and better transportation options, and we're not as well equipped as I wish we were. To look at the operators, those who use the rail lines, that is the freight railroads and Amtrak, volume has held up well until just middle part of this year, and now it's declining, but not as severely as truck tonnage, not as severely as aviation passenger miles traveled. Coal continues to be the economic and operational base of the rail systems. I saw the other day that the Burlington Northern Santa Fe, which is a conglomeration of railroads from the west, in September averaged 54 unit coal trains a day out of the Powder River Basin of Wyoming and Montana. And this coal is going great distances. I heard not too long ago of a move of coal, a regular move to a power plant in Macon, Georgia, that came out of the Powder River Basin of Wyoming. So about 2,000 miles hauling coal. And that is how some of the rail statistics that you read about and you hear about get boosted tremendously. And that's a good thing, but I don't consider it a permanent thing, because when you think about the Powder River Basin coal, it's low BTU coal, high water content, and ask yourself, and this gets to technology and alternative energy sources, how much longer is it going to make sense? It clearly will for a number of decades and maybe several generations, but how much longer is it going to make sense to haul coal from Wyoming to Macon, Georgia? So the rail industry has got some things to worry about, it seems to me. And here comes the professor, so I better watch what I say. Hi, Bill. I can only get by with holding forth with Bill's indulgence, because he knows far more than I do about railroads. The passenger side of the business, interestingly enough, is up in every category, whether that's commuter rail or light rail, urban transit, or Amtrak, which is having its best year ever. We all kind of measure things on a local level, and I have had occasion, as Meredith Richards knows well, to follow over the years the Richmond statistics, and they're up strongly. The Main Street Station on and off count, which is still modest in Richmond, is up about 50% over last year. And the Staples Mill, which is primary station in Richmond, is up, as I recall, 15 to 18%. So the public says, even though the service is poor, the fares are high, the public says we want this. So that has to be ground into the equation. The freight rail owners and operators, and I refer primarily to the executive class, the CEOs and those in that level of command, and I'm not attacking them, because I think if any of us were in the position that they are, we'd probably do the same thing. But what drives them is earnings per share and stock prices, and it's what the street, referring to Wall Street, thinks. It's not how many trucks they can get off the highway. Now, if they can get trucks off the highway and drive the EPS up, drive the stock up, so much the better. The short line situation is an interesting phenomenon, and you've got a great example of it here. Well, maybe more appropriately, the regional classification fits the Buckingham branch, but the short line operators are indeed, I think, a model for the Class 1 freight railroads to emulate in terms of customer service and quality of service and business development. But the sustainability issue is out there, because they really don't generate enough free cash flow to do the kind of reinvestment needed to perpetuate many of these lines. Not to pick on Bill Middleton, I'm not picking on him, but I admire him greatly, but he wrote a book about the engineering landmarks of the Iron Road or something. What's the title, Bill? But anyhow, lots of bridges, lots of big structures. And I've often thought that they are the Achilles heel of the private freight rail industry. I mean, picture replicating, replacing some of these marvelous structures. Whether they'll be able to do it or not is a question. In fact, the AAR has said in recent years, AAR for the Association of American Railroads, that they as a group will not be able to meet their capital requirements to maintain market share in the years ahead without public assistance. And that raises all kinds of policy questions. As for government, which is where the railroads increasingly are looking for capital, for funds, for major investment and reinvestment and so forth, at the federal level, we really have no policy, we have no money, and we have little or no vision for rail. And that's a real worrisome issue. The users, whether they be freight, shippers, or passengers, are not well informed generally. It's not their fault, but they don't know much about the intricacies of sustaining these rail lines. And many of the freight shippers are quite disenchanted. Not just, you know, there'll always be a fight over freight rates, but they're disenchanted with service quality. And I could tell you just, you know, because I have rail written across my forehead, people are always sharing with me anecdotes, and I'll not repeat these, but the freight service quality generally continues to be poor, with some notable exceptions. But look at the alternatives to rail and transportation. Things are not so bright there either. Aviation, commercial aviation, is a mess. Any of you who travel know that it is. Traffic is down, capacity is down, service is degraded, airports are hurting. I read the other day that Pittsburgh, and you've all been through Pittsburgh, that the Pittsburgh airport was designed to handle 30 million passengers annually. They're now down to 8 million annually. The USAL once had 450 flights daily at Pittsburgh, and they're now down to 60. There are other such airport stores around the country. The highway situation, both for the private users and for the commercial carriers, is also tough. I get most of my information just by reading, but you all read, probably as I did, that the Congress recently agreed to transfer $8 billion of general funds into the Highway Trust Fund because it's gone broke. At least it had no money to perpetuate the program after September 30. The inland waterway situation, while not as dire, but there are infrastructure needs, there are also missed opportunities there. I think we would do well. There's something, a concept called short sea shipping for coastal shipping that never has caught on here as it has in Europe and other parts of the world. But there are glimmers of hope. I used to be associated with a tiny little port of Richmond, which most people never heard of, but it's an active port with container ship calls weekly from Europe. Well, the Port of Richmond is just in the process of working out an arrangement with VPA, the Virginia Port Authority, to begin a barge service from Richmond to the three terminals in Hampton Roads to it'll not make up hardly a dent, that initial operation, but the concept is to get trucks off the highway, trucks out of the congested Hampton Roads area, and to use the facility at Richmond as a gathering point. International steamship or container ship business is, after booming, is headed down. I saw the other day that a year ago, the going rate for a box, a container from from China to Europe was $2,800, and now it's $700, and you can ship one back for $200. Clearly not sustainable. Intermodal, rail intermodal, is promising, but it isn't there. I mean, there are very few places, hardly any places in Virginia where a shipper can get on the system. And even if you get to a terminal, there's not service, there's not pricing, there's not rates. So there are a lot of opportunities, but a lot of missing pieces to the puzzle. As for government, again, to beat on government, as the presidential candidates are now, that's the only thing they agree on, is that they will beat on government. But as for transportation, we have a dysfunctional system. The silo effect, where aviation is in this silo, highway in this silo, ports and harbors, Corps of Engineers, really no comparable advocacy for rail, but that's beginning to change. And hopefully, with the reauthorization due next year, it won't get done next year, but it's due next year, of the 5 or 6 year reauthorization of the transportation bill, there are those in Congress who say they are going to make a real effort to try to get rail incorporated in that comprehensive program. The role of government in transportation, I don't think, can be denied. They really are kingmakers. Aviation and highways have, and I'm not against aviation. I'm not speaking against highway development, but they benefited from a strong government presence. The Department of Defense has been a major contributor, technologically speaking, for many modes of transportation, particularly aviation, and hardly any in the rail area. NASA, I don't reckon, has ever heard of rail. I wish there were a way, and maybe there is, to marshal all of the activities that go on under the auspices of the federal government and put rail on their agenda, because I'm sure there's work being done in many places that will inure eventually to the benefit of rail. Of course, we tragically read recently about the accident in California, Metrolink, and now the broader audience is being acquainted with a positive train control as a concept. In fact, the bill that passed within the last 10 days that would give Amtrak additional funding also calls for a program of federal assistance to the railroads in developing and applying a positive train control. I chuckle not about the tragedy, but about train control, because my little RF&P was a beneficiary of the Pennsylvania Railroad's train control system for years, and it's still out there, and it still works. It's an antiquated system, but it works. And we don't always have to go to the moon to get our answers. Sometimes the answers are lying around to be had. Obstacles to more and better rail service. You've heard me criticize the federal role. The worst thing, though, is we're broke. As we all know right now, nationally, we do. You know, there's only a little bit of money in the federal budget that's discretionary. By the time you get through defense, debt service, Medicaid, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and something else, there just isn't much to be fought for and divided among all the worthy potential recipients. There's another issue that I think is got to change, but I'll be doggone if I know how it's going to change, and that's the lack of good comprehensive planning in the USA. Now, I'm so glad to be here, to be a citizen. Don't want to be anywhere else. But we don't do a very good job of coordinating our land use and land development planning and linking that with transportation. Forgive me for always referring to my Central Virginia presence in the Richmond region, but I'm sure you all have been at least superficially introduced to the development in the Short Pump area, western area of Richmond. You know, the VDOT looked at what was coming and said to Henrico County, the local jurisdiction, this thing just, it'll overwhelm all of the transportation infrastructure. The county went ahead and approved it, and that's there. Now we're behind the curve. At the federal level, with the base closing and development of other military facilities, Fort Lee is an example down in Petersburg, and the region is happy to have the commitment of more resources and positions to Fort Lee, but the transportation element is never seemingly incorporated in all that. The freight railroads are a huge obstacle. They really are. Again, in case I didn't say this clearly enough, if any of us were the CEO of any major publicly traded freight railroad, we'd probably act the way they do. But their priorities are not necessarily compatible with the public interest. It's not that they are doing anything illegal, immoral, but, and this is only my version, if you ask a CEO what his priorities are, it's his personal wealth enhancement, the shareholders, the customers, and finally the public, if there's any room for the public. I don't know how this is going to be reconciled, if ever in my day, but a lot of people don't realize, and certainly a lot of these current railroad chieftains don't realize, that the public built or paid for most of these railroads. In Virginia, about 60% of the capital for the pre-Civil War railroad development came from the Commonwealth of Virginia through the Internal Improvements Fund, and another 10 or 15% came from the cities. Every major city in Virginia invested in railroads. Now, when they sold that interest, when the state went broke after the Civil War, almost broke, I don't think they really consciously contemplated giving up the public benefits that were associated with these internal improvements. The law is on the side of the private freight railroads. How we will ever reach a middle ground or compromise there, I don't know. But there's got to be more recognition of the public needs and public interest, not to the exclusion of the shareholders' interest. I've mentioned before what I've termed the irrevocable liquidation of rail network infrastructure. We can put some of it back, but a lot of it can never be put back. Much of it doesn't need to be put back, but a lot of it has been... The possibility of putting it back has been precluded by development, sale of properties. And then there's this natural and politically inspired anti-government, anti-tax theme. Now, I'm not here to volunteer to pay more taxes, but I think it's going to be necessary to get ourselves out of the jam that we're in. And everybody, if they're running for office, swears that they will not increase taxes. But I don't believe we can get from here to there without generating some revenue, and I don't know where it comes from unless it comes from taxes. At the Virginia level, Virginia's to be congratulated, I think, for making an effort to find money for rail infrastructure development. My complaint, as some of you know, is that we haven't organized ourselves to get the best return on our investment. The Department of Rail and Public Transportation is a well-meaning but outfit, but it's not up to the challenge, and they get bamboozled by the private freight railroads, who always have a scheme to spend the public money with questionable or inadequate benefits inuring to the public. However, as to the future, I believe, not because this is my first choice, but I think America's cowboy philosophy of don't fence me in is coming to the end of the line. I think the age of abundance is coming to its natural conclusion. By the way, I think this group can probably sing, "Give me land, lots of land, under starry skies above, don't fence me in." Well, you know, that has been sort of our guide as a nation, as a population. But when you look at demographic trends, land use issues, congestion, the environmental concerns, energy, national security, climate change, lifestyle, and economic competitiveness with the rest of the world, I think we're going to have to change the way we live. Somebody wrote recently, and everything I know I've stolen from somebody else. This was a guy by the name of Joe White writing in the Wall Street Journal on September 16. He says, and this context is alternative energy sources. He says, and he wasn't speaking against pursuing these alternative energy sources. But he wrote, "But America could install windmills from the New York Island to the Pacific shore and would still be dependent upon OPEC unless we change what we drive and where we drive and how we drive." I think that's a profound statement. My vision, and I don't know that I'll be around. It'd be pretty surprising if I'm around for the 2030 celebration. But 2030 will see Virginia Railroads or Virginia Rail Transportation enjoying a higher order of priority in the total scheme of things, I do believe. If I could paint a picture, and this is a brief picture, not a detailed one, my vision would be that at the federal level we'd have a fully integrated transportation policy and funding scheme where we invested in what's most appropriate and most environmentally and energy and cost effective rather than just continuing to do what we've always done. In Virginia, I think we desperately need a rail authority. I have advocated for that with no success to date, but I'm going to keep on because we can't get there with DRPT. DRPT is and they do good work, but their primary mission is grant administration for public transit properties for buses. Very important. No criticism of that. But that does not equip them very well because nobody running a bus operation in Charlottesville, for example, I don't know who that is, but nobody there is worrying about stock options or performance grants or special bonuses. The rail chieftains make a lot of money if they have good years. That's a change. You know, the railroad people, and I'm referring to the executive class, years ago sort of considered themselves public servants. Not totally. But nobody got rich. Now, it's a big money game for the few at the top. And if I were in line to get that, it would cloud my vision, too. So it's the system. It's not the people. But I think Virginia needs to and will, I believe, fully develop its urban passenger corridors, and that certainly includes the 29 corridor, the 95 corridor, the 64 and 460 East corridors from Richmond, Petersburg, and we ultimately need to get to Roanoke and down to Bristol, and maybe a lot of other things. But the other area of opportunity, which is much more challenging, is to develop a rail intermodal operation with multiple terminals to get into and out of the system, so that if somebody in the Charlottesville area wants to send or receive a container load, a truckload of freight, they don't have to drive to Greensboro, Baltimore, or to Front Royal or Portsmouth to get it into the system. And even then, the system doesn't go many places. So I want to see rail developed on two fronts, passenger and intermodal. Now, this is not to the exclusion of coal and grain and all of the other good stuff that the railroads have a good chance of handling profitably anyhow. And you do need some physical separation for performance purposes, not safety purposes. The railroads are safe. They are well maintained, as Fred alluded to in his introductory remarks. I mean, you see a piece of track that's recently been worked today with the mechanized system, and it's a thing of beauty. So it isn't a safety issue. But the intermodal, meaning the truck, higher-speed freight, and the passenger, and I'm not talking about European high-speed trains. I mean, 100-mile-an-hour trains would be wonderful, not necessarily 190 or 200. But there's a lot that can be done and should be done, and I think will be done in Virginia. So if you're interested in seeing this happen, you may not be. Not everybody is. What is my prescription for getting it done? Well, we all need to inform ourselves, and this group probably is better informed by far than most. We need to constantly remind elected officials at all levels that rail rings all the bells. Ding, energy. Ding, environment. Ding, public safety. Ding, quality of life. Ding, sprawl and congestion inhibitor. Ding, engine of economic growth. Ding, cost-effective transportation. And, clearly, we need to vote for candidates who get it. So, I'm optimistic that there'll be a party in 2030. I think you can go ahead and reserve the tent. I think you probably don't want to get the biggest tent that can be had. Maybe a medium-sized tent will do. But I'm a believer, and there's nothing that has changed my view that rail ought to be in the mix in a very prominent way, and I hope I live to see it. And with that, I conclude my remarks. If anybody's got a challenge or a question, let's have it.
Told you I didn't. From what you're saying, and I missed the very beginning of it, the logic in terms of energy and in terms of environmental impact, in terms of CO2 emissions, says that the most fuel-efficient way of transporting goods and people should be the recipient of the most public funds for the development of infrastructure. That makes rail absolutely imperative to develop if we're going to meet any sort of carbon dioxide reduction goals, or if we're going to be able to reduce our dependence on foreign oil. That, to me, I think your 2030 date should be advanced by at least 15 years. It should be a high priority to immediately expand rail in order to meet these dual goals, because our national security depends on it. So I think that we should be looking for politicians and looking for people to advocate for that, for the use of rail, wherever it is the most fuel-efficient means of transport.
I completely agree with that. The 2030 came about, and maybe I didn't notice when you arrived, but the 2030 came about because that will be the 200th anniversary of rail in Virginia. And we were speculating upon what might rail in Virginia look like and be like then. But I'd, if you can advance that by 15 years, let's have it.
If we had the will and the wallet to reclaim some of that 106,000 miles of rail infrastructure that's been lost, how much would be available?
Well, you really wouldn't need to reclaim 106,000. I mean, if we could get 20,000 in the right place, it would do marvelous things.
Is there that much still out there?
Well,
some of it's been used, I would imagine.
Been redeveloped, yes. But there's another dimension to it that I didn't describe. And you can go to Bill Middleton's rail encyclopedia in the back of it and get some of these numbers. It isn't just the route mile. That 106, 107,000 since 1970 was line miles, route miles. But maybe the even greater damage has been the paring off, the elimination of multiple track. Let's think of it in terms of highway lane miles. There are relatively few city pairs in the U.S. that are not still rail-served. But oftentimes, the most direct route has been abandoned. And even more often, the multiple track analogous to additional lanes of highway have been eliminated. So the first thing you might want to do is put back. In fact, this is what is happening today in various places across the country. Multiple track miles are being put back. But I can't imagine that we would need 106,000 miles restored, but a piece of it would be a huge step forward. And the tragedy is, and you know, sometimes I say I'm an equal opportunity offender, that I, in the course of one of my rambles, I'll offend everybody in the room. So there's somebody here that I'll step on their toes with this. But the Norfolk Southern, excuse me, Fred, abandoned 38 miles between Burkeville and Pamplin in Southside Virginia in 2005. I gave the right of way to the state park system for hiking, biking, trail. That was a grievous error. Now, if Norfolk Southern didn't need it or didn't want it, I'm not saying they shouldn't be able to get out from under the burden of maintaining it, but the state of Virginia should never have lost that link, because it's analogous to going from a four-lane highway to a two-lane highway, because the remaining line is basically a single rail line that runs south of Fumble. So the liquidation process is still going on, and but little pieces like that are devastating. And let me tell you how that has happened subsequent to the 1980 Staggers Deregulation Act. You know, at the time, I was an active railroader, and I thought most of what Staggers was about was contracts and rates and so forth. And that was most of what it was about. But the ICC, which has now been replaced by the Surface Transportation Board, which I describe as a lapdog of the rail industry, under this great deregulate everything concept, encouraged the railroads, encouraged the ICC, the act encouraged the ICC to make use of exceptions to the prevailing regulations. So they promulgated an abandonment scheme, which the railroads have made great use of. And what you do in a case like that is run off the business between Burkeville and pamphlet, and then declare there are no customers here, and then proclaim that we can still serve both ends, and you go to the STB and you say, this is a burden, financial burden, and nobody's hurt by this. And the STB grants an exception so they don't have to go through the full advertisement and full hearing process. And first thing you know, a good piece of railroad's gone forever. So that's what's been going on. I can argue the other side of that, having suffered through the old ICC process of trying to get rid of something that wasn't really needed. But there are a lot of opportunities around to pick up and put back into service bits and pieces, but many of them are gone for good. Sorry about the long-winded answer.
I've been fascinated by an advertisement that CSX Railroad has that says that you can move a ton of freight 423 miles for a gallon of fuel. Now, I'm a physicist by training, and that's an order of magnitude better, apparently, than if you truck that same ton with a, you know, put it on a truck. And if I think of the physics, I just don't see where that order of magnitude difference comes from. And so then I thought about it some more, and I thought, well, yeah, you've got a train, it's incredibly heavy and so forth. Generally, our trains are old-fashioned. They were built to carry particular kinds of loads and so forth. And probably if you added a ton to a train that was already loaded, you might be able to do that. But the question is, what does that have to do with anything? And so my question to you is, just you talked about freight scheduling and logistics and so forth and so on. I'm curious, what would it take to go to a situation for this country where I want to move a ton of my household belongings, let's say, from coast to coast, and instead of having Mayflower truck it, Mayflower actually goes to a local destination point, puts it on a train, and it gets off, you know, in California somewhere, and then it gets to wherever I'm going. How much would gas have to cost to have a break-even point where that would actually begin to be competitive, for example, or ship a ton of vegetables from California to the East Coast by train, not by truck?
Well, let me start with the 400 miles. That's a very misleading claim made by the railroads. Because all tons are, not all tons, but many tons are different. For example, if you're moving a coal train, it's going to be far more favorable in that measure than if you're moving TV sets in a container from Mexico or from the port of L.A. In intermodal. So the railroads are not... and I think that's a Norfolk Southern ad, by the way. Is it? Well, I haven't seen the CSX ad. Anyhow, they really don't make the distinction, and maybe they don't need to make it for their purposes. But you got it right. Now, I don't know, but what household goods aren't being moved today by rail in some instances, but you don't deal with the railroad. Railroads are not good, freight railroads are not really good at customer service. I'm sorry to say that, but you know, if the mentality, again, I'm stepping on Fred's toes, I'm so sorry, but he's a big tough guy and he can stand it. You know, if the railroad guys could have their way, they'd have a train load of whatever from point A to point B and deal with one customer and be done with it. So they're basically wholesalers of transportation. And somewhere in this country, consolidator, broker, transportation broker, maybe maybe taking advantage of rail intermodal service to move household goods, but you can get it done, and you won't ever get it done by the railroads. Well, they kind of morphed into some other categories now, but the same function continues. I have always thought, and this is a heresy for the railroad industry, but I've always thought that the federal government should make a deal with the class ones to buy and pay them fair value the interstate equivalent network in rail, and perhaps give the sellers some exclusive freight franchise for a period of time. Maybe it's 10 years, maybe it's 15. But the only way you'll eventually get the full utility out of the rail infrastructure network is if it can be used effectively, efficiently, and in a cost-effective way by FedEx and UPS as the retail face on this. Anybody else I can offend? Yeah, Bill.
Let me make a comment on the question about shipping household goods by railroad. I don't know what's going on in the household goods business, but I am aware of something that was true at least a couple of years ago and probably still is, that the largest shipper of intermodal freight by rail is the United Parcel Service. And that's all this stuff comes, it goes out retail by trucks, and it gets on the train, gets wholesale moved, and off on the trucks again. And several other railroad freight companies are operating exactly the same way. There's tremendous amounts of that freight going on the railroad right now.
Converse of what you're suggesting, that the government give encouragement, tax credits or allowances to the private company railroads, the converse of that would be, why don't we charge citizenry what roads and airports really cost? Why don't we do it in a cost control method of charging people exactly what it costs them to use it?
Well, I'd vote for that, but I don't think you'd get enough votes. But it's a sound concept. In fact, that's one of the issues with the way the state of Virginia is attempting to facilitate more movement of freight in the 81 corridor, because they're giving money to Norfolk Southern, not against Norfolk Southern, but it reminds me of the days not too far back when the federal government would spend money to discourage the use of tobacco and spend money to encourage the growing of tobacco. Because what we're doing on 81 is offering a real bargain to the highway users, the truckers. And there's no way that any freight railroad, whether that's Norfolk Southern or CSX or anybody else, can compete for the full range of business when the alternative is priced below market by the public.
But if you give credits or whatever compensation to these private companies, you're going to get into political prejudices, one's favored over the other, and so forth and so on.
We already have, and it's a developing problem. And that's why I champion, nobody's listening, but I champion the state rail authority, whereby the rail authority, instead of giving money to the private operators, would build, maybe they'd lease the right to put an additional track on the private freight rails right away. But they'd own the track, they'd charge something for the use of the track, analogous to highway fuel taxes or so forth, and they'd maintain control of it. What we're doing now is going sooner or later get us in hot water. I recently said to someone that if a new version of Henry Howell, you remember Henry Howell? If a new version of Henry Howell came along, he could have a field day with what DRPT earnestly is trying to do, but I think there's a flawed approach there.
You made some comments about the street favoring railroads, and that seems to be true. And 2 days ago, I got a flyer from an analyst up on Wall Street liking the railroads. They made a very interesting comment. They focused on Norfolk Southern and their corridor concept, the Heartland Corridor and maybe the Crescent Corridor. I'm not sure I know exactly what that is. Could you explain a little bit more?
Norfolk Southern, in conjunction with the Port of Virginia, that's the Virginia Port Authority, came up with the idea of improving, primarily by increasing tunnel clearances in Virginia and West Virginia, the old Norfolk and Western main line west of Roanoke to ultimately Columbus, no tunnels in Ohio, but at least not on this route. But so they got a lot of money from the feds as part of, I think, the last highway reauthorization program. It's being handled as a highway project at the federal level. Virginia came up with $32 million, of which about $20 million is for this intermodal terminal facility that's become so controversial out in the Salem area, beyond Salem. But the pitch by the port and by Norfolk and Southern is that they can save a day in transportation time between the port of Hampton Roads and Columbus, Ohio, which is where a big rail intermodal facility is being added to that already existing logistics complex. And that the port of Hampton Roads will therefore be much more competitive with New York and other East Coast ports. Now, that's a good concept, but what has not been taken into the calculation by the state authorities, nor by the federal people who didn't even give it much consideration, is that NS is already moving a good part of that traffic in two very circuitous routes, either up to Harrisburg, PA, and west to Columbus, or down to Knoxville, Chattanooga, I don't know which, and up Cincinnati and to Columbus. So NS is going to save a bundle of money, operationally speaking, which is good, but we, the taxpayers, didn't get any credit for that. It's probably the best deal NS has ever made in the whole existence of the railroad. So it's not bad. It's just we ought to be smarter in cutting deals. We ought to, you need to have the interest of the parties roughly aligned rather than one getting all the goodies and the other putting out all the money.
One question, and this is not with the freight, but with this express passenger service for rail. And there was a contrast between Pennsylvania and Virginia. And they said Pennsylvania can do express transportation by rail much easier because the government owns part of the railroad. And in Virginia, it would be very cost prohibitive because Virginia state government owns none of the railroad tracks. And so therefore, they would have to purchase time on the track or something from the railroads. And that would be prohibitive in cost because the railroads prefer the freight.
Well, that's true, but it came about because that was the Philadelphia to Harrisburg old main line of the Pennsylvania became an orphan in the Penn Central Northeastern Rail restructuring, Conrail, and so forth, and Amtrak wound up with it. Nobody else wanted it. So that made the development of that so-called Keystone Corridor much more feasible from a mechanics standpoint. Now, Virginia had much the same opportunity in the reign of L. Douglas Wilder, when the RF&P was the state cashed in its shares of RF&P. Had the state of Virginia said, instead of coveting this RF&P real estate, with which I'm rather familiar, and it was good real estate, but that shouldn't have been the state's primary interest. The Wilder administration and John Milliken was Secretary of Transportation, who should have done a better job at that time on that issue. Just let the folks at the retirement system of Virginia proceed to get the real estate and effectively forfeited the railroad to CSX. Now, CSX should have, under that, my concept, state should have held its interest in the railroad. CSX should have gotten a long-term favorable franchise agreement to run its trains, but it would have given the state a leg up in negotiations. And many of you may know that the state of North Carolina, which as a native Virginian, I have some difficulty conceding this, but North Carolina has been way ahead of us on a lot of things in the last 50 years. And they had a somewhat similar situation, and they went the other direction. The state of North Carolina had a major interest in the so-called North Carolina Railroad that runs from Charlotte to Greensboro, across to Durham, Raleigh, Goldsboro, and so forth. There was other interest. In the state of North Carolina, while Virginia was giving up its claim to the RF&P, North Carolina was buying out the minority shareholders and now owns that piece of railroad fully, free and clear. They lease the freight rights to Norfolk Southern, which is good, but they are in much better position to develop passenger, which they're doing. They're about to put on a third round trip between Raleigh and Charlotte. And they take the income from the railroad, the North Carolina Railroad, and reinvest it in the infrastructure to enhance it for better service. So other states have done things differently. I'm constantly frustrated because, you know, railroading is not rocket science. Engineering is, but railroading generally is not rocket science. But very few people in policymaking positions in government, whether it be state or federal, are sufficiently familiar with the nuances to know when they're giving up something of real value.
My concern is with petroleum in this context. Railroads today, freight railroading, is dependent on diesel fuel. That's a high-priced component of your operations today. And that fuel price has been rising. And that's a problem. At the same time, things like airlines and trucking operations that also depend on petroleum-based fuel, they've been having price problems. And in the end, the railroads are going to win that contest because of the efficiency. As we were discussing earlier, the steel wheels on steel rails are the most efficient way to move cargo. However, in the end, in the 20-year period that you're looking forward to, if you're saying 2030, in that period, the availability of the petroleum, not just its price, but the actual availability of it in the market is going to be a big problem. It's just plain going to go away. And we don't have any assurance of a replacement. And that means the railroads also are in trouble. I think the correct national policy is revenue bonds that would fund electrification of the Class 1s. and I can do a back-of-the-envelope calculation that says the cost would be something like $50 to $100 billion to electrify the Class One railroads of the country. That strikes me as a real good deal for our country, because it's going to be harder and harder to run this country with 18-wheelers. And the railroads, steel wheels on steel rails, are going to work well just as they did in the 19th century and in the 20th century. They'll work well in the 21st century, too.
The electrification concept comes around and goes around every 15 or 20 years. It's coming around again. It's an expensive proposition, but it may well be the answer, just as you have. Maybe the answer in the rail interstate network, if you follow what I'm saying, boil down the system to 50,000 miles of high performance, high capacity electrified system, and do it right. I suspect that will happen in a decade and a half.
Get to ask my second question. I heard on NPR when they were talking about this $700 billion bailout and all, and the problem with the banks, that an alternative would be when you require banks to have reserves. At the moment, they can be in the mortgage loans and the derivatives and so forth, and in monetary aspects. But a possibility would be a law that said at least 5% of the financial reserves for a bank or insurance company or whatever requires reserves to be put into infrastructure. And therefore, 5% of the reserves of these banks could be put into funding railroads, funding highways, fixing bridges, whatever, in alternative energy. So what do you think of the possibility of requiring 5% of the reserves of financial companies, banks, insurance companies, whatever, to be placed in something that is concrete, like infrastructure?
Interesting concept, but I don't know enough about Mr. Paulson's plan to really comment intelligently. We certainly have a serious problem with our national infrastructure complex of all modes, all shapes, forms, and that's going to confront us. It already is confronting us. The railroads, and let me finish with this, if I may. The railroads, I beat on the railroads right much, because I'm one of them, so to speak. But in the corporate DNA of railroads, they have an enormous skepticism of anything related to the government. They hate doing business with the government. This might be traced back to the grandeur movement of the 1870s and 80s and the Act to Regulate Interstate Commerce. It might touch Teddy Roosevelt and his efforts to crack down on big corporate wheelers and dealers. At that time, many railroad chieftains. It certainly dates from the World War I takeover of the U.S. rail system by the Woodrow Wilson administration. Although they benefited enormously from Roosevelt's New Deal, Reconstruction Finance Corporation, and so forth, they don't much like New Deal type stuff. And now they think they've got the public where they want them, because the public, use Virginia as an example, is beginning to give them money. Now, why, you know, this is rhetorical, why would you want to get involved in any complex dealings where you have to pay somebody back if you can get the taxpayers to give you money? I think that's a short-sighted, foolish notion. But and I there's a little of that in me, although I worked hard at running against that current of traffic, so to speak. Back in the days when we had, there must have been 250 or 300 freight agencies of railroads in Virginia 50 years ago. Every crossroads had a little station with an agent operator there. And some of those got to the point that there was nothing going on. I mean, nobody got on off the passenger train. Nobody shipped anything. And so we would have to go to the State Corporation Commission and work up a case to get this agency closed. And I spent untold hundreds of hours on that sort of thing in my day. And when you do that, you think, gosh, I don't want to deal with government at all. They also, during the tough days of the 1960s and 70s, track inspection regulations, which were certainly called for, came into being. So you had the FRA track inspector 1 week and the State Corporation track inspector the next week. This weighs on you. But that's got to change. We're in a new world, and the ideal is with the railroad burns and the public policymakers somehow finding middle ground, because the public is getting left out and denied something they should have. Thank you very much.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Daniels.